here. Parade updates, listener call-ins, the latest on Joe Dougherty, a Kate Borger Irish music special from 5 till 6, and much, much more.
So join us as we celebrate the 229th historic St. Patrick's Day, as it's led by the first woman Grand Marshal, Dorothy Hayden Cudahy. And WBAI here will be marking the day with Progressive Analysis.
That's Friday, March 17th, from 9:30 a.m. till 6 p.m., only on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
Good evening and welcome to News of the World. I'm your host, Emmanuel Goldstein, and what we're going to be doing for about the next hour or so is taking a look at the many different broadcasters of the world, at least some of the many different broadcasters of the world, and the different ways of life, different views that are currently going out over shortwave radio. There are a multitude of different cultures that all broadcast in English, and they come over your shortwave radio. Now, for those of you who don't know what shortwave radio is, you have to pretty much take a look at your current AM simple radio and imagine yourself going higher and higher on the AM dial. The highest number on the AM dial is 1600, and the shortwave spectrum begins at about 3,000 or 4,000 and continues all the way up to about 30,000, and spread all throughout those magical numbers are radio stations emanating from all kinds of distant lands, speaking in all different languages 24 hours a day. And what we'll be doing tonight is hearing firsthand some of what goes on over the airwaves. Now, historically, we in the United States don't really listen to other radio stations from other countries. We don't really have a need to. Everything we need comes to us right here on the three major networks, or so we think. What I hope to do tonight is show how there are other views, other stories. And hopefully at the end of the hour you will ask yourself if a half hour or an hour or however much news you listen to in a day is enough. Are you getting the full picture? Now, coincidentally, in today's New York Times, there were a couple of interesting articles about shortwave, one article in particular about shortwave called Governmental Candor, Now Shortwave Staple. Unusual title with no byline either. Seems to have been wiped right out of there. From Radio Afghanistan to the Voice of Zaire, more official government radio stations than ever before are broadcasting abroad on shortwave, and many have started downplaying strident propaganda and overt ideology in favor of more candor in their official newscasts. Now, basically, what that translates to is countries like the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China have been more open in their shortwave transmissions. Now, we'll be hearing an example of each of those tonight, and you can judge for yourself whether or not they are in fact more open. Now, people who monitor these international stations, and you could very well be among them if all you have to do is buy a radio and start playing around, they say this trend is evident in other countries as well. Now, because of shortwave radio's range, countries have used it to project their messages across geographic and often ideological and religious divides. And, of course, some countries have not been affected. Extremely strident propaganda can still be heard on Radio Tirana coming from Albania, and Pyongyang Radio, which comes from North Korea. And some analysts say that Moscow Radio has not actually abandoned propaganda in its broadcast. Its messages have simply become more subtle. What we're providing for you tonight on this program is a chance to judge for yourself and hear it firsthand. We're going to start things off with a commentary that was taped tonight off the British Broadcasting Corporation, and it has to do with the elections in West Germany. An extreme rightist party has won 7 city council seats in Frankfurt, West Germany. That occurred yesterday, and Chancellor Helmut Kohl's Christian Democrats lost control of the city government. The extreme right National Democratic Party took 6.6% of the vote, according to preliminary results, winning representation in city government for the first time since 1968. Let's go to the BBC.
BBC World Service, and now we come to commentary. The elections in the West German state of Hesse have provided more evidence of the decline of the ruling coalition of Chancellor Helmut Kohl. And as Donald Armour of the BBC now explains, it's the marginal parties of right and left who are benefiting.
West Germany has had 2 decades of humdrum politics, mirroring its relatively placid prosperity. Now things are changing. In January, Chancellor Kohl's party, the Christian Democrats, lost control of the West Berlin city government. And it lost mainly to an extreme right-wing party called the Republicans, who made a sensational breakthrough. The Christian Democrats lead a center-right coalition at national level in the West German capital, Bonn. They grew alarmed at the Berlin result and looked forward nervously to the results of municipal elections in the state of Hesse. Now, the most spectacular result in this election was in the big city and banking center, Frankfurt, which is also the capital of Hesse. The Christian Democrats lost 13%, dropping from nearly 50% at the last election. In addition to the Republicans, there is another extreme right-wing party called the National Democrats. And in the municipal elections in Hesse, this party has now re-entered Frankfurt politics with over 6.5%, gaining 7 seats at the expense of the Christian Democrats. The opposition left-of-center Social Democrats and the left-wing environmentalist group called the Greens made marginal gains and are expected to form a coalition city government. Meanwhile, the Christian Democrats feel quite devastated. They see a trend against them which could affect them at the next national elections to a new government in West Germany, and these take place in less than 2 years, in December 1990. The Social Democrats and the Greens have been profiting by default from Christian Democrat losses, and they're forming their own coalitions. But the Social Democrats, who are the other mainstream big party, cannot take very great comfort from the voting trend either. Analysts are pointing out that the trend is away from the big parties and towards extreme margins on both the left and on the right. The right are doing especially well. The reappearance of the National Democratic Party reminds one of concern about them 20 or more years ago. The reason for the new popularity of the right is the growing issue of foreigners living in West Germany and West Berlin. Both radical right parties, the Republicans and the National Democrats, campaigned on an anti-immigrant ticket and did very well out of growing resentment among German voters at the large number of foreigners already resident in the country and still more trying to seek residence at a time of high unemployment. The extreme right wing does not represent a threat to German democracy. The latest vote in Frankfurt could be interpreted more as a protest at the way things are going in Bonn. So the signs are not there yet that the voters are drifting irreparably away from moderate politics. On the other hand, some commentators fear that the Christian Democrats, desperate to restore their vote, may be tempted to copy the more nationalist line of the more extreme parties in order to court their voters and adopt an increasingly intolerant attitude towards foreigners. Meanwhile, the Social Democrats and the Greens are already putting the finishing touches to the new coalition in West Berlin. Some observers see the nucleus of a new red-green coalition, as it's popularly called, which will run the next national German government in Bonn from next year, Alternatively, the Christian Democrats may yet find themselves Sunday in coalition with an extreme right party instead of their present partners, the liberal Free Democrats. It was a Soviet prime minister, Mr. Alexei Kosygin, who some 19 years ago once expressed concern to the then German Chancellor, Willy Brandt, about the neo-Nazis, the National Democrats. Brandt replied confidently that the problem would be resolved at the ballot box. It was, then. But now they're back, the National Democrats, hoping to make more gains on the back of a new mood among many West Germans.
Commentary by Donald Armour was broadcast from the BBC London. Well, now, if you're listening in the Americas and are finding reception difficult, this is the result of an ionospheric storm which is affecting transmission over the North Atlantic. You may get a better signal by retuning to a lower frequency. Well, in half an hour from now, you can catch up on...
And we're going to fade out right about there. That interesting note as far as a solar flare or an ionospheric storm is rather unusual because of the seriousness of the situation. In fact, it even made the paper today, a series of large solar flares, each with the potential to disrupt radio transmissions, erupted in a wake of an unusually large blast. One blast was 36 times the size of Earth. And there were actually three explosions on Saturday, so we were affected by that. That was actually the best signal available. A lot of us have trouble listening to shortwave radio for a long period of time because of the reception and the high-pitched whining and the various difficulties involved in listening. But I think you'll find if you just stay with it for a while, you'll become used to it. We're not using entirely material that we've received over the radio in this hour. We have some tapes that we've received directly from some broadcasters, and we'll be getting to that a little bit later on in the program. No, there's nothing wrong with your radio, and there's no point in smashing it to bits because of that annoying sound you keep hearing. What that is an interval signal. And if you're a frequent listener to shortwave, you would know that interval signals are used to identify radio stations. What's the point? Well, if you're going down the radio dial and you're looking for a broadcast from some country, and they're broadcasting in another language at that time, or they're not on the air yet, you would have no way of knowing when you got to them. This is an easy way for you to be able to tell what station is about to come on the air. In this case, the station is Radio Deutsche Welle, the voice of West Germany. What they do is they play a theme over and over again until the hour comes up, and then they stop playing the theme and usually play the national anthem or some time beeps or something to that effect, and then they begin their regular broadcast. This particular one is the interval signal for Radio Prague in Czechoslovakia.
Your station is Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia.
And this rather pleasant melody comes from Radio Netherlands. And other times you may come across continuous bells that go on for as long as 15 minutes, which also indicate that a station is about to sign on the air.
Your
But these are only a few of the sounds that you'll hear on the shortwave spectrum. A lot of people listen to shortwave, but they don't really listen to what is being said. And as we mentioned before in this program, we hope to be able to actually listen to some of the things that are being said on shortwave. What we have now is a tape that was sent directly to us from Radio Moscow. It's called Moscow Mailbag. And what they do in this program is answer questions sent to them by listeners in the United States. Some of the answers are rather humorous, and all of them seem to reflect the new openness in the Soviet Union. But I'd be particularly interested in hearing from listeners as to whether or not they believe it's sincere, or whether, as the article in today's New York Times said, the propaganda is just a bit more subtle. This is from Radio Moscow.
Prior to the Soviet invasion, people display a lot of
This is your program, Moscow Mailbag. And here's Joe Adamoff to answer your questions. The first letter is from Reverend William Peek from Buffalo Center, Indiana, who is interested in Protestant Soviet Christians.
Well, as far as I know, we have two Protestant churches in the Soviet Union, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, members of which are to be found in Estonia and Latvia. The Estonian congregation is governed by a consistory headed by an archbishop. The Latvian congregation is governed by the Supreme Church Assembly, also headed by an archbishop. Then we have the Methodists, also in Estonia, governed by a superintendent. The Evangelical Christian Baptists, which are very numerous in our country, I believe are considered to be Christian sects, not part of the Protestant Church, or am I wrong? Well, you probably know that the church here enjoys much greater freedom nowadays, Reverend Peek. It is now quite common to see members of the clergy on television or sitting in the Central Election Commission during elections to the Congress of People's Deputies, or say the fact that over 600 Russian Orthodox churches have been opened of late, or that the Prime Minister Ryshkov visited Catholicus Vazgen I of all Armenians during the earthquake in that republic. These, in my opinion, are all signs of the times. Just the other day, there was a big article in Izvestia saying that if a choice had to be made when promoting a person between, say, a religious person and an atheist, a person's religious views should in no way, directly or indirectly, be held against him.
Reverend Peek would like your feedback on a booklet he has sent, Training a Child, which is Christian literature.
Well, I've read the book. I guess we both realize that to bring up, to train a child, is a most complex thing. I would say that we would subscribe to 80 or 90% of what that booklet said. I read it carefully. The booklet says parents are the fashioners, the shapers, the trainers. The child in adulthood will be the person the parents have formed. Then, let me continue quoting, children who are withdrawn, uncommunicative, are often surrounded by adults who are strongly preoccupied with something else. Reverend Peek, we know in our country that so-called problem children or difficult teenagers often come from divorced families or from families where the parents are heavy drinkers or where there was no understanding between the parents and children. I also agree that the maximum possible demand or discipline must be enforced. There must be the maximum possible respect, and we must show love and care, forgiveness and mercy. So you see, we have very much in common.
In his letter, Walter Schlobaum from Aptos, California, writes the following. Let's consider construction standards. In the U.S., we have very stringent standards when it comes to how buildings are built.
Well, I have no doubt that you do.
An interest guide in Leningrad told us these massive apartment-type structures are completed in as little as 30 days. Since the buildings are constructed without concern for earthquake damage, it is easier to house millions who need homes.
Walter, you live in California, which is a seismic zone. Our seismic zones are the Transcaucasus, Central Asia, the Crimea. I'll give you a few facts. There were earthquakes in 1963 in Yugoslavia, in 1970 in Peru, in 83 in the United States. Now, the number of victims in these places was several times less than in Armenia, though the force of the quakes was the same as in Armenia. You see, in Armenia, all new buildings crumpled like a house of cards. But those built 25 years ago survived. Why? Because 25 years ago, in Armenia, buildings were put up to withstand a quake of that force, just like in other countries. Then, some local officials decided it was quicker and cheaper to ignore the seismic danger. 9-force earthquakes occur once in several hundred years, they figured. Nothing seemed to have taught them a lesson. Even the 9-to-10-force quake in neighboring Iran in 1978 didn't teach them a lesson. Besides, much of the concrete used for the buildings contained more sand than concrete, as Mr. Gorbachev noted when he was in Armenia. So there was theft, there was corruption here too. Now, Mr. Slowbone, I do not agree with you about the construction, say, in Leningrad or in Moscow. Mind you, these are not seismic zones. An author of an article in Pravda, a scientist of the Hydrometeorological Institute, says that all buildings not answering to standards in the seismic zones should be torn down to make them safe for people to live in, and I agree with him.
More from Walter Schlobaum. While in the Soviet Union in 1987, I coined a phrase, the Russians could put 100 tons into space, but can't hang a mirror straight in the restroom.
Well, I'm afraid that holds true for many things that we did in the past. I guess we have to live and learn.
Bruce Hightower from Greenville, South Carolina, asks if any of the children's films by Walt Disney have ever been shown in the USSR.
Oh, yes. We saw the very first films in our country back before the war, such films as Three Little Pigs. We saw Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Bambi, and many others. Mind you, we produce hundreds of our own. Some are good, some are plain bad, and some are excellent. Very popular today is a series called Just You Wait, where a little hare always gets the upper hand over the big bad wolf.
Gerald Cantlin from New Haven, Connecticut, has this comment. While it's an interesting ability to hear you behind the Iron Curtain, most of it does come under the heading of disinformation. I find it challenging nonetheless.
Well, Gerald, you're welcome to your opinions, but I'm sorry, aren't you a little behind times? Why not give me some examples of this disinformation? Have I disinformed you in this program today? Do you call the unilateral cut of our army by 500,000 men, by 10,000 tanks, 6,500 artillery pieces and 800 planes, do you call that disinformation? Or our year-and-a-half unilateral moratorium on nuclear testing, is that disinformation? Our 14% cut in military spending and 20% cut in military production, what is that? Or take our pullout from Afghanistan or Glasnost. Are you sure it's all disinformation? Come on, Gerald, try to forget the past and be more fair.
Charlie Thomason from Longview, Texas, who is a radio announcer, wants to know how popular stamp collecting is in the USSR.
I cannot but answer a radio announcer. Charlie, stamp collecting is exceedingly popular. There are millions of collectors, not all are members of any clubs, mind you. Why the stamp collectors are such a big public group that they elected their deputy to the Congress of People's Deputies here in the Soviet Union. He was cosmonaut Viktor Gorbatko, who's been up in space twice. He is the chairman of the Philatelic Society. We have won hundreds of medals and prizes at no end of international exhibitions.
Are there many stamp clubs?
Well, you see, there are about 1,000 clubs, what we call circles and sections, under the National Society of Philatelists, which has about 400,000 members. They publish a monthly magazine called USSR Philately. But as I've said, there are millions of unorganized philatelists that are not members of anything.
And another question from Charlie Thomason from Longview, Texas. How does the USSR select topics for its stamps?
Stamps are issued by our Ministry of Communications. Now, the ministry has a board in charge of issuing and distributing stamps. They decide what topics, what events ought to be chosen for the various stamps that they issue. Then they announce a competition among the artists for the best design, and they pick the best ones.
Rhea Ward from Grove City, Florida, writes this: I have listened to Radio Moscow for over 40 years.
Well, then, in that case, you deserve a medal, which I would call For Patience and Stoicism in Pursuance of Understanding.
During my November 87 visit to the USSR, I was approached 3 times by teenage boys who offered rubles for dollars at 25 to 100% discount. How are these dollars used?
I suppose one day when the ruble will become convertible into hard currency, these shameful acts will disappear. I understand that the exchange rate, the official exchange rate of the ruble, will change, and very soon at that. But I guess the kids sell them at a profit to those going abroad and are in need of hard currency. Mind you, all foreign currency stores for Soviet citizens have been closed, so I don't see how they could use this money inside the country.
Ms. Ward has this comment: I believe some unsavory adults are corrupting boys who could be more usefully employed. Give them hell, Joe.
Well, you may be right. I would not rule out that there may be some adults running this little racket. As for giving them hell, you know, the press has been doing that for me for quite some time. But I personally feel that the police and the public order squads should clamp down on this business, in which maybe 12, maybe 100 or so are engaged. But gives us a bad name and creates a very bad image.
And we're going to have to fade it down right there, not out of censorship or anything like that, but because we do have other things to get to. That was direct from Radio Moscow, and you heard it here on WBAI in New York. The program is News of the World. We're exploring the world and looking at other views, other news programs, which many people don't know are broadcast every day in English. These come from virtually every major developed country and quite a few other countries as well. And we'll be checking out a few others in just a couple of minutes. Africa. I can tell by the switchboard that that has piqued the interest of quite a few people. What we heard was part of government-controlled or government-sanctioned, certainly, global news services out of South Africa. The kind of thing you'll hear every day, every night, in your own living room, in your own kitchen, wherever you set up a shortwave radio, this kind of material is occurring all the time, and it's there for people to listen to and to think about. And we're deliberately not passing any kind of judgment tonight, because we want our listeners to actually listen to what is being said. Now, what does the United States say insofar as shortwave radio? Does the United States even broadcast in shortwave radio? Yes, of course we do. If you look in the New York Times today, in fact, you will see in the word and image section a kind of a graph as to who broadcasts the most on the shortwave spectrum. You'll find the United States is number one, followed very closely by Radio Moscow. Now, where do we broadcast? Well, we're all over the place. We broadcast in foreign countries in Europe via Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe, but we also broadcast from this country, directly from Washington, D.C., over a service called the Voice of America. And that goes into Africa and Europe and Asia and South America. The one place it does not go to is the United States. In fact, it is illegal. It is illegal to rebroadcast the Voice of America in the United States. This is not even a federal communications guideline. This is a law, a United States Senate or Congress or something passed way back in the past dictated that the Voice of America will not be broadcast in this country. Now, why is this? This is kind of an unusual ruling. And the reason is to protect us, supposedly to protect us from any kind of propaganda that could be crammed down our throats by the government. Exact rule, according to the FCC, the way the FCC translates the ruling that came from a higher authority, programs originated by the Voice of America and the Armed Forces Radio and Television Services cannot, in general, be cleared for domestic rebroadcast and may therefore be retransmitted only by special arrangements among the parties concerned. Now, this presented a bit of a problem for us here at News of the World because we wanted more than anything else to, well, not more than anything else, but certainly we wanted to very, very greatly, I guess, we wanted to show our listeners what the Voice of America sounded like. Now, how can we do that if we're not allowed to rebroadcast the Voice of America? Well, we asked some legal people over at the FCC who were very helpful and understanding, and they suggested that if the signal was received in a foreign country and then somehow sent back here, then we wouldn't be breaking any laws. So what you are about to hear now is a rebroadcast of the Voice of America, which came, I believe, last week sometime, was received in an African country that wishes to remain anonymous, and then sent back here via satellite. So what you are about to hear is part of that transmission here on News of the World. And after that, we will be taking some phone calls at 279-3400. So if you want to give us some quick feedback, we'd love to hear from you.
A major concern of government computer users, and for that matter, private users as well, is keeping their systems secure. This concern was underscored by events 1 week ago in West Germany. Authorities there arrested a so-called computer hacker on charges that he had conducted electronic espionage by tapping into secret military data networks in the United States. This past year has also seen more problems with computer viruses, the kind of electronic sabotage that can disrupt machines and destroy data. A number of firms specializing in computer security were at Bossy. One of them was Enigma Logic of Concord, California. Company Vice President Joseph Hootman says security is increasingly important because computers operate as part of interconnected networks.
Well, it used to be that the computers were standalone systems and we could put them inside a room that had a secure door or perhaps even a guard associated with it, and there were no outside connections to the computer. Now, with the advent of telecommunications and networking, we find that there's much interconnectability between computers and people not in these so-called guarded fortresses. And certainly the advent of the personal computer and the addition of, to the personal computer of the modem has really opened up this interconnectivity, and that's both the facility of this kind of networking and the avenue for computer abuse.
This sort of technology has become very widely available, and as we saw with the arrest of a West German computer hacker last week, it is possible to enter computer systems from literally thousands of kilometers away. Is it indeed possible, given today's networks, to maintain good computer security?
The technology to do that is certainly there. It's in place. There is hardware that is interest and have spent the money to provide adequate protection for their computer systems. This is starting to change now that we've seen some of these events, such as the one you mentioned.
And if that sounds surprisingly like the kind of thing you might hear on regular commercial radio, it's not surprising. A lot of it does sound like that. There is subtle propaganda mixed in, especially on a program called Good Morning Africa, which is sent out every night and beamed over to that part of the world. So that was the voice of America as heard over in Africa and then beamed back to us to make it all legal. The voice of America transmits virtually around the clock in all different languages, and it's a very interesting service to listen to. And I should point out, in case people are concerned about this, it is not illegal to listen to Voice of America in your home. It is just illegal to rebroadcast it directly live over airwaves or taped over airwaves without special permission. Now, as I said before, we will be taking phone calls at 279-3400. So if you have any feedback or comments on some of the things that you have heard, we do have a couple of minutes for that. And we do have one more feature after the phone call, so if you do have a comment to make, please make it now, 279-3400. Hello, good evening. Is anyone there? Apparently not. Hello, good evening.
Hello, would you be able to recommend to your listeners an inexpensive shortwave radio?
Well, I can't actually recommend a specific model. I would say it's a lot easier to use a model that has digital display, because then you can focus in on a particular frequency. Frequencies on shortwave are very specific.
I see.
They'll say tune into 9070, and you have to find that. You can't really find that very well on the dial unless the signal is very strong.
I'm talking about price range here.
Price range, I would say probably for a good one, probably you're talking about $400, but it is a very worthwhile investment.
It's a fascinating show, Ian. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, thank you for calling. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. If I could just make a couple of comments, I enjoyed this show.
Go ahead.
The best thing about shortwave radio is that once you buy the radio, that's like the last investment you make in it, and it's a lifelong hobby. Just two quick comments for people out there listening who do have shortwave radios. The shuttle transmission, a rebroadcast, all of them on 7185 kilocycles. And for people who might be into other things, the Drug Enforcement Agency has chase planes on 8912 kilocycles upper sideband. Okay.
You touch upon a very interesting point there. There are many other things to listen to besides actually the radio stations that broadcast information or propaganda. There are ham radio operators, but there are also things on sidebands such as Drug Enforcement Agency, the FBI, all kinds of things are hidden in there. So yes, you're right, it's a lifelong hobby. And once you get the radio and you hook up what we call a long wire antenna, which is basically what it sounds like. You run a wire from the radio and attach it to a fire escape or telephone pole or something like that. That serves to pick up the stations from all over the world, and you're set. Okay, thanks for calling.
Sure.
Hello, good evening. You're on.
Well, good evening. I should preface my remarks that I rarely agree with what I hear on WBAI. I listen. I'm not calling for the car. I listen on the way home. But I congratulate you on wetting some folks' imaginations as to what's going on the shortwave dial, including Radio Moscow and South Africa and whatever. I think it broadens some horizons, which I think has a great deal to recommend it. And I would also, I'm pleased that you didn't editorialize for the most part. You kind of slipped in a little propaganda remark on the VOA. But by and large, you just said, we're not going to try to color your opinion, just let you know what's around. And I think that's a good service.
Well, thank you. That's our intention, to just let the news of all these services be introduced to people, because the average person does not even know that Radio Moscow broadcast in English. That's the biggest response I get. I didn't know you understood Russian. Almost every country broadcasts in English to some degree, and they all have something different to say.
English is the universal language. A lot of folks would like to think that's French, but that's just not true.
Well, they do broadcast in other languages, too. They don't just broadcast in English. What's interesting, if you do have a shortwave radio and you're able to pick up the European service of Radio Moscow, which broadcasts in the daytime, it's not hard to pick up either. You'll hear them talking in very crisp British accents. And then when they switch to the North American service, suddenly they have American accents. It's an interesting thing to notice.
Radio Moscow has changed rather dramatically. I remember a million years ago when I was in the military, and I was an intelligence type, Radio Moscow wished me happy birthday, which was supposed to have unnerved us, and we know where you are and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
But things have changed a little bit now with Glasnost and whatever, I guess.
Well, with the advent of Glasnost, I think shortwave radio is going to be a very interesting place to listen.
It's always been interesting, and I think it shall continue to. Congratulations.
Okay, thank you for calling. We'll take one more call. Good evening. You're on.
Hi. Yeah, back in the early 60s, my friend Barry, his father got him a Hallicrafters vacuum tube shortwave radio. Beautiful black radio with a chrome rim around the dial, and we used to listen to Radio Moscow and many broadcasts from many countries and stayed up late listening to it. It was fascinating. Well, I was up in Maine about 2 years ago visiting my brother, and at a garage sale, there was the Hallicrafters black radio, vacuum tube radio, for $4. And there's probably a lot of them sitting around. And the only thing that was wrong with it was that the filter capacitors, the electrolytic capacitors inside, had to be replaced because those are the things that deteriorate over time. So if you can find one of those, just replace the electrolytic capacitors, and they work fine.
Yeah, if you're an electronics person, you can find shortwave radios all over the place, sold ones in garage sales. For the person just being introduced to it, I'd recommend something a lot easier to understand, mainly the digital models, and that way you can get the most fun out of it by exploring.
Yeah, you said it like $400 for a good one, and that might discourage some people. I thought I saw some Sony portables for about $100 that had digital displays.
The last time I checked, the price was a couple of years ago, so they may very well have come down since then. I would suggest checking in an electronics store and just picking up a copy of maybe Popular Communications or something. They have the latest models there.
By the way, let me ask you, a long wire antenna, about how long should it be, and does the orientation, east, west, or north, south, matter?
Yes, the orientation makes a difference as to which stations you'll get better. East-west, I believe you'll get stations that are to the north and to the south, whereas north-south, you'll get vice versa. The length, the longer the better, generally. But any amount of wire will help. Any amount of wire is generally good. And you'd be surprised at what you can pick up.
If you string it across the room, say 15 feet from one corner to the other.
You can try that. You can try that and just play around with it. You'll probably pick up some different things.
Well, thanks very much. I hope this show keeps on. It's very good.
Okay. Thank you for calling. We have one more feature coming up. Before we get into it, though, there's two books I'd like to recommend to the listeners who are interested in pursuing this. They are the World Radio TV Handbook, and what that is kind of a guide to all the different services that are out there. There are, as I said, many, many hundreds of radio broadcasters that have things to say. That have news to read and features and interviews. You'll hear exclusive interviews with people that you won't hear over here, like an interview with Mikhail Gorbachev, for instance, that you would never hear the transcript of in this country. World Radio TV Handbook gives you a guide to the different services, how to recognize them, what their interval signals sound like, and where to write to them. And the other book I recommend is formerly called Radio Database International. Now it's called Passport to World Band Radio. If you have a shortwave radio, it's very important that you know when something comes on, because a service may be broadcasting in English at 8 o'clock, and then at 8:30 they'll switch and start speaking in Spanish, and it can get very confusing if you don't know where to look at what time. This book, I think, captures it in a better way than any other attempt I've seen at it. And I'll give the address to both of these organization so that you can look into more information on this subject. World Radio TV Handbook can be written to at 1515 Broadway, New York, New York, 10036, and Passport to World Band Radio at P.O. Box 300, Penns Park, Pennsylvania. That's P-E-N-N apostrophe S, Penns Park, Pennsylvania, 18943. And we'll be giving away a couple of copies of those, too, at the very end of the program. But before we do, let's listen to something from Radio Beijing here on News of the World.
Shortly after the normalization of Sino-U.S. relations, Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping visited the United States. During that trip, the China Central Television provided extensive coverage, showing for the first time to its hundreds of millions of Chinese audience a seemingly spotlessly clean country where everybody was rich. Truthful or not, every evening the television program brought every Chinese with access to a television to the tube. With their eyes glued to the screen, they commented vehemently on such lovely scenes as the Disney World and the rodeo show where Deng Xiaoping wore a 10-gallon hat. 10 years later, that romantic feeling still exists for most Chinese, although many of them have come to a sober realization of their differences with the Americans. Last weekend, I went to the Purple Bamboo Park, where English learners practice the language every Sunday. I talked with about 20 of them. My questions ranged from who the next American president will be to where Hollywood and Broadway are. The most revealing answers, however, were on what they thought were the best things and the worst things about the United States. For the first question, these are some of the answers.
Well, I think students in America study work harder than students in China, I think. Last week I came here, a foreigner told me, and foreigner and American students didn't watch TV in their spare time. They just work hard.
I think the Americans do things is very effective.
I think their pupils have very good character. They are very friendly to the foreigners.
I think the best thing in United States is democracy and freedom.
The work hard spirit, manager system. I don't got to say the system. I just say the manager system. Maybe the important point, I think.
But what about the things they dislike the most?
Maybe this rug. maybe the sex liberation. I don't think that we can obey it from our traditional culture.
Maybe it's just another guy I listen to the sex freedom. Maybe it's. And it's a bad side. We all know the AIDS disease, right? This is also a kind of freedom, right? It's one aspect of freedom. But I don't think this freedom is truly good.
When I asked which American author they best liked, none of them could come up with a name, although all said they read American novels. Finally, somebody shouted from the back of the crowd, "O. Henry." I then asked if anybody read Li Iacocca's book, which had been translated into Chinese. One girl made these comments.
I read several pages of it, but I think... No, I don't like it because it's meaningless sometimes. Because that he is American and he... live in American society. That society is completely different from Chinese society. And his managed method doesn't fit Chinese situation.
On the question whether they thought Chinese media's coverage of the United States truly reflected that country's reality, one young man said no, adding there were too many negative reports. But another man immediately disagreed. He thought the media coverage of the United States had been far too rosy. All the people I talked to did not have any difficulty answering the question who the next American president will be, but none knew the name of George Bush's running mate.
Well, that can probably be said of quite a few of us here in America. Unfortunately, we have to end the program on that note. Obviously, that report from Radio Beijing came to us from last year. We get tapes from Radio Beijing on a fairly regular basis, but I thought the viewpoints of Americans was certainly interesting and revealing as Beijing People's Republic of China goes through opening of relations with the United States and with other parts of the world as well. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we are giving away some books, some copies of some books. For the first nine callers, we have copies of the World Radio TV Handbook, and your choice, actually, World Radio TV Handbook or Passport to World Band Radio. So hopefully that will get some people started listening to shortwave and exploring the dials for alternative opinions, not just on FM. If you listen to WBAI, you'll hear all kinds of alternative opinions here. But there's all kinds of things going on all over the world. And I like to say that there's just so much happening out there. You really owe it to yourself and those around you to listen. Thanks for listening to News of the World. My name's Emmanuel Goldstein. I've been your host for the last hour. And if you like the program, please write to us and tell us you like the program, and maybe the folks upstairs will make it into a series. Who knows? The address is News of the World, care of WBAI, 505 8th Avenue, New York, New York, 10018. Again, the first nine callers, we will give their choice of one of those two books, and just ask that you be patient, because it'll take a while to answer nine phones, so you might have to let the phone ring for about 10 minutes. We will answer all the calls that come in, even if you're a loser. Again, thanks for listening. This has been News of the World, and hopefully we'll see you again sometime. Stay tuned for a rebroadcast of the evening's news from Pacifica and from WBAI Newsroom. This is WBAI, New York.
South Africa's ruling party backs de Klerk in his challenge to President Botha. Skeptical reaction to the Bush administration's plan on the occupied territories, a settlement in the suit against the Teamsters Union, the Salvadoran military admits to a massacre, and how the Sandinistas are dealing with AIDS in Nicaragua. With these and other stories, I'm Amy Goodman, and this is the news for Monday, March 13, 1989. First to Tara Seiler in Washington with tonight's top stories. South Africa's ruling white national party today backed party leader F.W. de Klerk in his challenge to President P.W. Botha. As Ruby Lloyd reports, the leadership crisis in the ruling party has deepened following a surprise interview with Botha on state television last night, where he pledged to return to work on Wednesday.
President Botha, who suffered a mild stroke earlier this year, announced on TV last night he would stay in power until at least March next year. His announcement has reportedly dismayed members of his party and smashed speculation he could resign soon. After his stroke, the president handed over leadership of the ruling National Party to F.W. de Klerk. This led to speculation that Botha might also resign his presidency due to his health. His latest announcement, however, has made it clear he is prepared to fight hard to cling to his leadership position, even in the face of strong opposition from within the ruling party. Almost all National Party parliamentarians have called on him to hand over the presidency to de Klerk, and last night's announcement is sure to trigger off a bitter power struggle within the party. Meanwhile, the South African government is facing further pressure as rumors grow that detainees here could restart their hunger strike this week. Yesterday, thousands of South Africans marked National Detainees Day, and prayer services were held all over the country to honor detainees, some of whom have been held for over 1,000 days without charge. Libby Lloyd in Johannesburg for Pacifica Radio News.
Israeli Foreign Minister Moshe Arens met in Washington with President Bush and Secretary of State James Baker today. The administration reportedly gave Arens several recommendations for reducing the violence in the Israeli-occupied territories. But Foreign Minister Arens isn't expected to embrace the U.S. ideas. Laura Kanoy has the story.
The Bush administration is reportedly asking the Israelis and the Palestinians to take steps it calls confidence-building measures. According to the White House, if each side sees the other making step-by-step concessions, it will be encouraged to follow suit, and the current political deadlock will break. President Bush and Secretary Baker were expected to ask Israel to ease its grip over the Israeli-occupied territories. Those measures could include an end to Israeli destruction of Palestinian homes and property, nighttime curfews, forced closings of food markets, reopening schools, and releasing some Palestinians arrested in connection with the 16-month-old uprising, or Intifada. Secretary of State James Baker didn't outline any specific steps he'd discussed with Foreign Minister Ahrens, but Baker did hold to the United Nations position that the Palestinian people should have political freedoms.
We can and must find a way to move ahead which at one and the same time meets Israel's legitimate security needs and addresses the legitimate political rights of the Palestinian people. We reviewed the current situation in the West Bank and Gaza and we considered various reinforcing and reciprocal steps which might be taken to diffuse the tensions there.
But Foreign Minister Ahrens didn't publicly endorse any of Baker's proposals. Ahrens reminded Americans of his government's view that Israel is in a tight spot.
We certainly want to reduce tension. That is an interest that we have, quite aside from the interest that the United States government has on that subject, and I think that we will find common ground on how to do that. It's not easy to do that considering the violence in the area at the present time.
The U.S. is also reportedly asking the Palestinians for considerable concessions. Unnamed State Department sources quoted over the weekend said the administration wants the Palestinian Liberation Organization to end violent demonstrations in the occupied territories and stop distribution of so-called inflammatory leaflets. But a high-ranking Palestinian official in New York yesterday dismissed the U.S. proposals as not serious. Palestinians believe the U.S. is only asking Israel to soften its handling of the occupied lands while telling the Palestinians to give up everything. Nabil Shaaf, chairman of the political committee of the Palestinian National Conference, said yesterday, quote, "It is impossible to ask us to stop the Intifada just to build confidence. The Intifada is our only weapon." American Jews appear split over Israel's rough tactics in the West Bank and Gaza. Ira Silverman, vice president of the American Jewish Committee, agrees with Baker's premise that the Palestinians should have a homeland, but where to put that nation of Palestine is another question.
We believe that the 1967 lines are no longer tenable for various security reasons from Israel's point of view, and therefore there will have to be some readjustments, but we believe that that's exactly the kind of issue that the parties have to negotiate rather than listening to outside suggestions such as our own.
The West Bank and Gaza were not part of Israel prior to 1967. While the high-level meetings in Washington were going on, Israeli soldiers killed three Palestinians who were trying to cross the border from Lebanon into Israel. The conservative Shamir government said the incident shows the PLO can't be trusted to stick to its renunciation of terrorism. That promise, made in the last weeks of the Reagan administration, prompted the first official talks between the PLO and the U.S. in 13 years. Israel is bitterly opposed to the meetings, and during his Washington visit, Foreign Minister Ahrens is expected to make that clear to Baker and President Bush. Laura Kanoy, Pacifica News, Washington.